Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Jillie Jeezy, and this is Family Matters. I'm here with my co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Jill.
How are you?
I'm really good.
What's going on in Chicago? Oh, no, I want to know. You just went to California. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I did. I went to speak to the Collaborative Law Bar of California, and I just am so impressed with collaborative law and the idea of getting a mental health expert on from the beginning to help with the children. I mean, if there ever was an antidote to the premise of the show with parent alienation and marginalizing the other parent, it would be collaborative law.
Michelle, for people who are listening, you know, they may just be going through this. They don't know what collaborative law means. Will you explain?
Yeah, it's one of the options to going into an adversarial divorce. In an adversarial divorce, you fight each other. In a collaborative law, you make an agreement to try and make agreements, and you sign a contract that if it does fall apart, you do have to get a lawyer, which is the only downside of collaborative law, but you have a financial expert. It's like a team, so that whenever it gets sticky or adversarial, you have an infrastructure for handling all that. Everybody is devoted to keeping the bad emotions down, to getting everybody's needs met in parenting orders, to figuring out what the parents financially need to go forward, and it's a collaborative team effort to try and help families. It's really
good. So you think this reduces the instance of adversarial divorce and really cuts down on the financial burden to both parents?
Ultimately, it does. Right now, it's a little on the expensive stage, but the collaboratives are working on how to make it much less expensive and more affordable. Families should not be emotionally violent with each other. When there's a heartbreak of a family, the answer is not in the courts. It's in teams of people who know how to take the family into another place so that they can be productive and happy going forward and not adversaries. It's the right model, even though it's got problems.
Well, I love it that you are a family court judge in Chicago and doing such a terrific job, and that you're advocating for other avenues for resolution in divorce other than coming in, you know, to your courtroom and being in front of your bench. Although if I was divorcing, I'd want to be in your courtroom, because I know you are just amazing and revolutionary in what you're doing there.
Well, I don't know about that, but I could talk myself out of a job, but that's just too bad. That's just too bad. I just really think it's a good model. But anyway,
we have somebody on with us tonight who is being just so quiet and sweet, and we know that he's not quiet. We know he's sweet, but he's not quiet.
Yes.
So I am going to introduce now Stephen Walker. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Terrific. Michelle's here with us, and we are so excited. We've all known each other for a while, and we're happy to have you here tonight. You're a founding director of the Institute for the American Family, and that's an exciting thing. I'm an advisor on that institute, and you're the vice chairman of the American Coalition of Fathers and Children, Mike McCormick, the executive director, good friend of all of ours, and that's located in D.C. You're the editor-at-large of the ACFC quarterly newspaper, The Liberator. You're an advisor to the Foundation of Male Studies, co-director of the Children and Parents Network. And you just do everything you can to try to make a difference in divorce culture. And I welcome you, and I'm so glad to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to start by applauding what you two ladies are doing, because raising the bar, raising awareness for the public and the policymakers about the need for civility when it comes to dealing with family and family matters is very important. Watching you two and what you're generating right now is very, very important, and I applaud what you're doing. It's enlightening to see that two such prominent spokespersons are taking the stance you ladies are taking. I'd like to comment, if I could, one moment on the collaborative divorce. We about 10-12 years ago, that was introduced in New York, and I agree with you. It's a much better way to go. Problem in New York, and it may be a problem in other areas, was the attorneys sort of opposed it because it does cut out a good portion of the revenue that's generated when the adversarial process is allowed to manifest. So I don't know where it is right now in New York. I know that we had, I'm trying to think, Jacqueline Silverman was the matrimonial head matrimonial judge, and she was very supportive of it. And she's no longer sitting where she was, and you don't see much about it in New York anymore. But I would hope that that becomes more of a reality around the country, because it is very important. It's a much better step towards maintaining a non-adversarial process in the very beginning.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but it's definitely in the right direction. And it's catching on, certainly in Illinois, little by little by little. You even have two of the largest divorce firms in Chicago have a collaborative department. So that's a good sign.
Well, that is a good sign, especially when Illinois can do absolutely nothing right. And we are at the forefront of really a change in what's going on with children and divorcing families in America. And I love to be number one in that, since we can't seem to do, you know, anything that's good here. So,
well, you have something on your mind that you want to say, Jill, apparently.
Do I?
Yeah, I think you do.
Do I?
No. I mean, I don't know what it is, but...
I'm good. I mean, I just think...
Rough day,
you know,
did you?
I was yesterday, and the day before, I was at the Capitol, and I was working on a bill that they call the Stephen Watkins Memorial Bill. It's House Bill 1064 here in Illinois, and it was a visitation interference bill. It gave teeth to an existing visitation interference bill and penalties for people who withhold their children from a non-custodial parent. And that bill did not get out of committee yesterday. It was a shame. The votes were there. I'm not sure what happened. I didn't get to testify. It was unfortunate. There were many, many fathers there, many mothers that were there to support the bill, and it didn't make it out of committee. And I think that anyone in Illinois that's listening, please make the point to call your state representatives or senators and let them know how important it is, especially if you've had experience with adversarial divorce or visitation interference or parental alienation, and let them know that this bill is very important. I think that Senator Mattie Hunter, who is the bill sponsor, will call it again in the veto session, and I just think it's so important that we get some real repercussions for withholding children from a non-custodial spouse. So that's my piece. I have said my piece.
I can imagine why you're upset.
But, you know, Michelle, tonight we have Stephen here for a really specific reason. He has so much knowledge, but about this particular issue, you and I have very little knowledge, and Stephen was the go-to guy on this. And it is, we're going to talk about tonight suicide and veterans who are coming home from serving our country, such an important thing to all of us, our freedom, and how they represent us in Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam vets and all of the vets that are here that have been divorced, committed suicide, lost their children because they've been gone so long. And Stephen has all these terrific statistics to tell us that are just mind-boggling. So, Stephen, let's talk about, is there a hidden epidemic impacting America's military when it comes to divorce and suicide?
Well, that exact phrase, hidden epidemic, was more or less what CBS News went public with back in November of 2007. They had a fairly extensive study done that determined that for the first time in recorded history of America, the military suicide rate was double that of the general population. Between 31 and 35 folks per 100,000 who were veterans were taking their lives, compared to 17 non-veterans. And it was staggering. No one knew exactly why. The Pentagon and the Department of Defense began to dig a little bit into to research it, and they concluded that, yes, in fact, there was an epidemic, a hidden epidemic of suicide that no one had really paid attention to. And right now, it's not abating. There's been some assessments made internally within the Army at the very beginning. And believe it or not, the common denominator for veteran suicide was not deployment, nor was it multiple deployments. It turned out to be a failed relationship and the consequences of a failed relationship, which usually involve a family court experience.
But, Stephen, don't you think I mean, if you looked at it logically, that multiple deployments would increase the statistics in divorce if that person who's serving our country is off in Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam and they come home and their spouse is gone. Don't you think that certainly creates the circumstances for divorce and then the ultimate suicide?
No question. There's no question about that. The rate of suicide, like I said, which is probably more than double now, the general population, 70 to 80% of those taking their lives had a failed relationship as a common denominator. And it's definitely exacerbated by deployment and the time that's spent away from the family. Yet the underlying issue of the need for family court reform to change the paradigm with which military, and this is not just men now, there are military women who have taken their own lives because the shoe fits on both feet. When you're deployed and the other spouse decides to initiate a divorce, there are instances where a judge is listening to testimony via an internet or a satellite communication. There's no findings of fact per se. And it certainly does impact the deployment issue, certainly does impact that. As a matter of fact, right now, representative from Ohio, out in your neck of the woods, basically, Michael Turner from the 3rd District, he's actually introduced a federal bill to attempt to corral the issues. He wants to amend the Service Members Civil Relief Act to provide the protection for all child custody arrangements for parents who are members of the armed forces who are deployed, that the child custody arrangement cannot be changed while someone's being deployed. And that would be a major, major plus to alleviate some of the stress that a service member is going to face when he or she comes home and they find out all of a sudden that the rug's been pulled out from under them.
Well, just to go back to Jill's initial question, the studies that they did were interesting, as I remember reading about this almost a year ago, is that they would have expected that deployment would be the primary reason in the suicide rate, but it wasn't. It found out that it was exactly the stress of personal relationships falling apart, and 70% of those people had been involved in a bad experience in the legal process.
Yes.
I think my statistics are pretty close on that. And that was what was so shocking about this particular research.
Yeah. Michelle, has anybody come through your courtroom that was a vet that had issues? Do you recall anything at all that you can talk about?
No, because, see, if anybody is in active duty, the case is pretty much on hold anyway. If somebody's in the National Guard at Fort Dix, for example, you can get service on them, and you could litigate either where you are. It depends upon where the jurisdiction is. But in these kind of cases, when I substitute in paternity court, you would find people coming back from the military who hadn't seen their children, who were in arrears on an old child support order, who are just trying to crawl out from under and having a really difficult time. Because let's not forget the part about post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And when by the time, such a high incidence of soldiers coming out of Iraq or Afghanistan and Vietnam, they did a lot of studies too. And, sometimes they have high anger thresholds. I'll let Stephen talk about this. And there is upgraded violence with PTSD. So a lot of times they get a hold on their visitation.
Unfortunately, there's no mandatory deprogramming. There's no grief counseling that's mandatory for a serviceman that's been in an active theater and comes back home. One of the issues we'll address perhaps later on in the show with the gentleman who just finished walking across America to raise awareness for veteran suicide is the fact that we should have some program, some protocol that is mandatory, that a service person, male or female, that's been involved in an active theater is required to go through some sort of a decompression period because post-traumatic stress disorder is very real. And one of the statistics they found now is that because we are using a lot of National Guard individuals who have a acquired more or less a sense of stability in civilian life. They're not necessarily ordained with the inculcation of the military regiment from day one. They're more prone to the stress because it's such a it's such an exaggerated condition that they're going from a civilian position to all of a sudden they're over in Iraq or Afghanistan or someplace. And counseling, grief counseling, the fire departments in most major municipalities, the police departments, part of the basic training is grief counseling before the fact. Now, that's something that it would be totally new to the military, but I can tell you that that's something that they're going to be considering because that would certainly, I think, go a long way to alleviating some of the back-end stress that these ladies and gentlemen find when they walk back onto the street and they walk out of a military uniform and they realize that the world isn't the same.
But you know how long it took for them to admit to PTSD?
Yes.
For years, there was like, I mean, when I had another radio show, I did a lot of shows on this, and for years, there was just a few places in the United States you could actually get treatment that they'd actually say it existed.
Well, I mean, the military was hesitant to say it existed, and the military hides its head on a lot of these issues. And, you know, my father was the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for a very long time, and I know that many times that this subject came up and we talked about it, and they said that's just something that we don't want to address. It's just something that they know is there, but they don't, almost a hide your head in the sand kind of thing.
Yep.
And I think if you look at the veterans today from Iraq, Afghanistan, the Kuwaiti war are very different than what we did with Vietnam vets. And I'd like to break those two groups apart, Stephen, if we can, and strictly address the Vietnam issues, because I think those are the forgotten soldiers for sure, and we have not served them as we should have in the United States of America. And if you look at the statistics, since 1975, three times as many Vietnam veterans have committed suicide than were killed in the war.
Yeah. Well, part of what happened there, Jill, you're absolutely right. Part of what happened in Vietnam, Vietnam War had an anti-war movement in this country that was fermenting for some time, and you had three movements. You had the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the feminist movement all galvanizing at the same time. And flipping back to the Korean War and World War II and World War I, our military and the powers that be had recognized shell shock. They recognized that there were mental disorders that were common with combat veterans. We've actually seen memos that when Vietnam, at the height of Vietnam, when the anti-war movement was really percolating, military brass was told to play down any mental issue. And the Vietnam veterans who came back here, who were basically spit upon, were denigrated, were called baby killers. The first time in the history of the country, we were denigrating the military. Veterans, military people, weren't setting the foreign policy. They were just doing what they were told. But they came back to a void, and unfortunately, that void has never been addressed properly. You know, some years ago, I actually asked the federal Congress for a formal apology for the manner in which the Vietnam veterans were treated, because they deserve an apology. And it's not just the veterans themselves now, it's their extended families.
Mm-hmm.
If you fast forward a little bit now to Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan, there are a couple of things that play into account. First, technology has advanced. Many, many individuals who were wounded in battle in Vietnam and World War II and Korea would not survive. Today, however, that's not the case. Triage is excellent. Artificial limbs, a variety of technical advances have been made. So now we have a much higher rate of individuals coming back here, more or less bandaged. Now, the body can be repaired. You can put an artificial limb on, but you still can't change what's going on, what's ticking upside in someone's head, the experiences that they've had. So there is a void there as well right now. Post-traumatic stress is something that should be looked at more seriously. In March of 2009, federal Congress allocated $50 million to the Department of Defense to address the suicide issue for Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans primarily. And they gave that $50 million to the National Institute for Mental Health and basically said, come up with a pill. Come up with some symptomatic way of addressing the problem rather than look at the underlying issues. And I think that was a waste of $50 million personally. I don't know what's been done there, nothing from what I'm gathering, because, again, the rate of suicide has not abated. But something's got to address the underlying issue, and that would get back potentially to a military protocol that got into mandatory, not voluntary, mandatory deprogramming, a mandatory program where you had to sit down and you had to go through some sort of a course after the fact to try to bring you back to a state of having a little bit of balance.
Well, there's a couple of programs, and I can't really speak to how well they work. I do know that there's I may not be saying the title right, but Veterans Affairs PTSD program, and there's veteran centers where families are told that they could go for some help. So there's something that does
address
that.
There is a Band-Aid. There's no question, Michelle, that there are some programs out there that do attempt to deal with the issue, but it's rampant. I mean, you know, one of the statistics that really got to me is that, and this comes right out of the Pentagon, while 18 veterans a day on average take their lives. That's the public. 18 veterans a day take their lives in America. 70 to 80% common denominator failed relationship. More than 1,000 1,000 a month try to take their lives and aren't successful. Now that is staggering.
Staggering because if you take that 1,000 and you take the 70%, then we're saying for 700 people that were involved in our court system, it was problematic, you know.
Problematic,
Whoa. I mean,
I'm going to jump
in.
And
I have to say, just in Cook County, we have programs where we do educate the judges about how to understand the military law. It's not really the law we're talking about, though. We're not really talking about that. So you can know the law, but that's not really the problem.
Right.
You're right.
Stephen, do you find, what are the statistics of soldiers who are never deployed? They're here in the United States. Are there any statistics on suicide for people who are not deployed?
Well, I'm sure there are, but I would be remiss if I tried to give you any accurate numbers there because I really don't have those at my fingertips. I will say this, though. We had a press conference last year at the National Press Club in D.C., and we made veteran suicide the front-line issue. And one of the folks that spoke was Valerie Moran. She's actually the wife of Ron Zaleski, the gentleman who walked across the country. And she made a statement which caught everybody by surprise. She said that Ron averaged 10 to 12 miles a day walking. Every day he walked, at least one person walked up to him with tears, thanking him, saying they had either a friend or a loved one who committed suicide and they were a veteran. Now, she connected the dots and she said, can you imagine if somebody every 10 to 12 miles of the American highway was dying from a flu? Or was dying from some other ailment, that would make the national press on a daily basis. You couldn't get it off the front page. And yet, that's what's taking place in America today, and it's not getting any kind of headline.
Can we back up for a minute so that people, I mean, we're talking about failed marriages in the military, we're talking about PTSD, and about the suicide rate. Let's go back and talk about what happens to those marriages for a little bit and what exactly are the problems that these people in the military are having to endure.
Well, like everybody else in America, having relationships is not easy. You know, men and women are different. We have natural tendencies that are different. We have a natural, you know, testosterone and estrogen are not the same hormones. We perceive our realities differently. And there's a recognized and then there's unrecognized stress associated with anybody in the military. If you're a life type individual, someone that's raised in the military, and that's what you're going to you're going to retire from the military, then you're going to put your life there. Many of the women who accept that as the format of their spouse, they're locked into it. Stress, though, child rearing, faithfulness, the economics. I mean, our military, in my humble opinion, is underpaid. It's very difficult to live in America today and be considered middle class, depending on where you are, and you know, not make at least mid five figures. And that's not what the military is about. Military is it's basically right down to the line. So the financial stress is always there. The underlying issue of getting advantage. You know, I know that both you ladies are very sharp on the parental alienation, where one parent, for the purposes of denigrating the other parent, turns internal warfare. That's very, very common in a lot of the military families who have fallen apart that we've seen. Terrence Popp, who is out in your neck of the woods, he's a 24-year Army Ranger from Michigan. He has a video out that I think anybody that's interested in this should Google on the internet and find. It's called The Purple Heart. He did his own investigation, and he found that the majority of women who were the surviving spouse of a vet who took their own life had a very calloused indifference about the whole process. And he dug a little bit. He found basically it was because the minute the guy got deployed, they were always looking for greener grass. They wanted to find something else was out there. And the majority of those, by the way, turned out to be National Guard individuals. They were not the military folks who are in it for life. And I would imagine, Michelle, that a lot of the same circumstances you see on a daily basis when you're sitting there listening to the lawyers arguing, you listen to Mr. Jones and Mrs. Jones, those same circumstances I think would be the common denominators for what takes place in a military family. But I also think you're going to have a lot more stress because of the fact that there is a sense of ownership by the government of the whoever's in the military, and the fact that there's not a whole lot of money flowing there.
Well, the additional things that I have seen in the case where somebody's deployed and has been in active combat and then has come back is there's a certain shutting down, less self-disclosing, anxiety. Apparently, they are saying anxiety around intimacy and sexual dysfunction. And, you know, a whole distancing thing. I mean, people think that the spouse that's over, you know, has been in combat, comes home, gets off the airplane, and the non-military spouse thinks everything's going to be okay.
Well, you know what, Michelle, as you say that, though, Michelle, it's very similar to an alienated child. You know, you think if that child comes back, everything's going to be the way it was before. Somebody different is walking in the door, and it's not the same guy or gal that you knew when they left to go overseas. If they've got PTSD or they've got any kind of emotional issues that they're bringing home with them, that's something. And maybe you can address this, Stephen. Maybe they need to counsel. Maybe there needs to be a program in place for the people that are the spouses that are left here while these men and women are over there serving our country. Because if we can get to these spouses that are running off to look for greener pastures, to let them know that that's not the best thing to do, to stay here and support your husband or wife while they're off serving our country, and to try to hold everything down. I know that's difficult, and just try to get your bills paid and do everything you can do. But I mean, maybe that's the answer.
Well, you know, you two make a very good team. I'm listening to you, and you both connect the dots very well. I applaud the way you work together, because I started to say, and I got a little sidetracked, that the deployment is sort of a de facto alienation process unto itself. And a lot of times that's exactly what happens. You know, Michelle was articulating the anxiety, the sense of potentially sexual dysfunction, the trauma of looking at maybe your best friend getting killed. These things have an enormous weight emotionally on a service member who's been deployed. And when they come walking back off the plane, for a spouse to think that, you know, as Johnny went across, Johnny's come back to say, that's not even real. I like your idea, Jill, about potentially involving a protocol and a program where not just the deployed spouse would be deprogrammed and have some sort of maybe grief counseling before he goes out or she goes out, but the spouse who remains here would also. But that would have to be voluntary, wouldn't it, Michelle? I mean,
well, yes, but I bet people would be very happy to get that kind of
aid.
And I would add something on to that, and I think Jill is really on the right track. There is also, when the person who was deployed comes back, there also is a phenomena called caregiver's burden, which means the non-military spouse has to pick up a lot of the slack, a lot of the house upkeep, a lot of the taking care of the children. The partner, the military partner, is somewhat compromised, at least for a while. And they call it caregiver burden. So there is the immediate need for help to know that your spouse is going to not be the same, what the alterations are, and how to cope with them. But secondarily, a certain self-care that the spouse has to give themselves because of all that they have to be taking on, not the least of which is the emotional strain from the amped up hostility and your spouse being shut down. Then they're not really getting any help. Jill's right.
Yeah.
I would think if you did a program even once a month for these spouses that are left, and some of them, you know, pregnant, some of them with new babies, sometimes it's dads who've never been, you know, the caregiver for the children. And if you did a once a month program to keep them supported, just the support of knowing that there's other people like you, would just like in parental alienation, there's other people like you, and we are here for you, someplace you can go, so that they're not, so they feel like they have a camaraderie, they feel like they have fellowship, and they feel like they're not sitting there by themselves and then going out to look for greener grass.
Yeah. You know, we have a protocol. We're looking for ideas for grant funding. We have a whole grant process we're putting together right now. I'm gonna mark that in my little book here. That's got some real serious potential. It really does.
Well, you know, fortunately, the new Secretary of the Army lives two doors down. So I'm going to go talk to him and see what he thinks about this idea, because I just find this to be so fascinating that there's this whole world that Michelle and I kind of knew was there, but we never really have talked about this. And I think if we can help these people, then why not? Let's do it.
There are some studies out there, and I don't have them with me. I really didn't. I'm not, I guess, fully prepared for this. But there are some studies out there that show that the underpinning of the military, which is that camaraderie, is actually being eroded by the suicide issue right now. Suicide is so rampant right now that, you know, many people, I mean, they're, I'm not going to say preoccupied, but they've got to be occupied with it at least in some way, shape, or form. We're talking about 18 veterans a day taking their lives. That's a phenomenal number. So any kind of program right now, aside from trying to invent a pharmaceutical pill that you're going to take, I kind of laugh at that, that they spent $50 million looking to the pharmacies to be able to come up with something, because I don't see how you can alleviate the underlying cause of a failed relationship. I don't know any kind of a candy pill that's going to take that and you know, massage that and make that a better situation.
So Stephen, is there anything pending federally or in any state, and this has to be a federal issue, that would address any of this at all,
well,
any of the underlying causes?
There are a couple of states that have tried to deal with the issue of not impacting a deployed service member in any negative way, but it's a patch quilt. Now, as I mentioned a little earlier, Representative Michael Turner from the 3rd District in Ohio, he introduced H.R. 4469, which didn't get up for a vote. I'm not sure exactly what new number it's going to have now with the 112th Congress, but he's reintroducing it. And basically what it would do, it would amend the Service Members Civil Relief Act to provide protection for deployed service members regarding their children. And that is a real serious issue. The veterans I've spoken with and the ones that have been interviewed who survived but had friends who took their lives, the real common denominator of the failed relationship was the fact that they had children and they were denied access to their children. We've got testimony from veterans who stood in front of a judge in their military uniform because they were still on active duty, and they were denigrated by the judge, saying, "Who do you think you are to come in with that uniform? You're trying to impress me?" I mean, I've got testimony from a gentleman right out in Michigan that gets right into that. So some sort of protection on the federal line for anybody that's got children and is involved in any kind of active service would be appropriate. So Michael Turner from Ohio has a bill pending. Your listeners out there in Ohio, in Illinois, any place around, you can contact your own congressman. He's got 35 sponsors for it already. In my opinion, it would be a very, very good first step, because what it would do potentially, it would establish a federal precedent for not directly intervening in what's perceived to be a state's rights issue. Family demise and family relationship issues are usually considered state's issues. But when you've got something like this involved, you've got to have a little bit of oversight. So I think it would be a very good first step along those lines. And Representative Michael Turner from Ohio is sort of a champion along those lines right
there
now.
There is a program called the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program, which is a program that is trying to readdress the coming home aspect when you're coming from active combat. And the second thing is, I just have to say this. I have to. The judges that I know are extremely respectful of the military.
That.
Don't forget, in some way they see themselves as uniformed too.
Mm-hmm.
So that could have happened. And you're always going to have that aberrant stuff. But from what I see, and when we talk about it, we go to the seminars about it, they tend to even, you know, judges will sometimes call their case first, bend over backwards. In my courtroom, I have everybody stand up and thank anybody who's in the military. And I don't think I'm the only one. So I just want to say.
I'm sure not.
No, listen, judges, we make a lot of mistakes. Don't get me wrong. We're far from perfect. But on this particular one, that's not really the sentiment.
Well, I want to stop you guys for a second because Ron Zalewski's on the phone. And I've got – hi, Ron. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Good. I'm going to let Stephen introduce you because he knows all about you, and I want you to do that. Stephen, can you do that for me?
I sure can, Jill. Thank you. Ronald Zalewski is a Marine. He was a Vietnam veteran. He's a native Long Island gentleman. Ron has got a very activist mindset. He found out about veteran suicide some time back and post-traumatic stress disorder and what was not being addressed. And being the kind of a gentleman he is, he decided to make a statement to raise public awareness as he felt he could. And June 1st of 2010, standing in front of the Concord, Massachusetts Monument, where I believe the first shot in the Revolutionary War was started, he began a trek across America. It took him 10 months and change. He walked 3,600 miles barefoot, no shoes, no socks, carrying a sandwich board that basically reads 18 vets commit suicide a day, and then he's got his logo, his website, which is thelongwalkhome.org. He's been carrying a petition. He's made some very, very strong friends in Congress. He's got a couple of governors now because he's been making an effort now that he's kind of driving back. He walked across. He's driving back to get governors involved. And, Ron, I want to applaud you on – I guess we're on international radio here right now. God bless you for what you're doing. And, you know, you want to take a little bit of the stand right now and give the public an understanding of what it is you're doing and why you're doing it?
Yes, I would love to do that. And before I start, I would like people to go to that website, thelongwalkhome.org, and look at our petition. It's a 3-point petition. Take a look at it, read it, and sign it, because a lot of people say, what good is my signature? What good is one signature? And I used to feel the same way. But I realized that if I had 100 million signatures and I walked down the streets in front of the White House that every congressman and senator would be standing at attention and the president would be opening the door if I had that number. So everybody's signature means a lot, and the only way I get it is one at a time or people going on the website. And the three-point plan is we want grieving or loss of life and limb counseling for them before they get out of boot camp to help prepare them. It's called, now they call it a resiliency program, which they've already done studies on and found out it's effective. And the second part of this plan, and this could be done in a seminar series, they could do like 100 men or more at a clip, and it would only take a couple of hours. So it would be cost effective. It's going to cost them less than, you know, the things they do now. And then the second part, we want mandatory counseling for everybody before they get discharged. They have programs that are effective, but it depends upon the officer. And also, there's such a stigma with PTSD that, you know, I don't know of anybody 20 years old or older that would admit they have a problem, especially somebody that's been in the military that's supposed to be self-reliant, you know, strong, a leader. You know, who's going to say they have a problem? And we've made such a stigma, it looks like a problem. And it's, you know what, it's, you're not broken. There's nothing wrong with you. You're human. You put any human under that kind of stress, this is what you're going to get. If they just called it post-traumatic stress instead of adding the disorder, because now that makes it seem like there's something wrong with you and you're broken. And the another reason why we want to make this mandatory is it takes away that stigma. And it takes away a lot of the officers don't want their men to get counseling. So they do have ways of discouraging them so it doesn't look bad on their record. So
that really makes a lot of sense. And plus, you don't, if it's mandatory, nobody's singled out.
Right.
Right. And
just
also
shaming
you're doing it,
if you're a soldier.
Doing it in a, yeah, and you do it in a seminar series. The guy next to you may have a problem, and he'll voice it. And the guy next to him may have the same problem, but is afraid to say anything. So they all get help. There's a lot of, you know, group dynamics here that's very powerful. And also, when we do it as a seminar, we want to give them tools so that they can make that transition home. Because, you know, everybody you talk to, that has somebody in the military, they say, you know, my son came home, he's not the same person. You know, there's a lot of good things that have changed with him, but he's not the same person. You know, he doesn't smile anymore. He's not, you know, all of these things. And the person that's changed, they're the last to know that they changed. You know, the person
that's in trouble
is always the last to know.
You were a Marine, Ron. Why did you choose this particular? Certainly, there's lots of things you could have walked across the country for, but you felt an attraction and a passion for this issue. When did you serve? Tell us about that and why.
I was in 1970 to 72.
Okay.
Before I was even in, my father was in World War II. Most anybody my age had somebody that was in the Army back during World War II. And my father came home and had no tools. He drank every day of his life. He beat all of us kids. He branded me when I'm 8. And my father loved me. But he didn't have the tools. When I got older, I realized he loved me and he did the best he could. But, you know, because of him, you know, everybody affects 25 to 30 people around him. And the family is in the impact zone. And all of us children had, you know, abused drugs, alcohol, and been in jail. You know, my sisters hadn't been in jail. Or if they had, they hadn't told me. But my brother and I certainly had. And so, you know, they have such a huge impact on the rest of society. You know, they say it's only 7%. I hear this term, acceptable collateral damage. Well, that 7% affects the entire population of this country. And, you know, it's not only, you know, the 18 a day is just the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg is, you know, the drug and alcohol abuse, the family abuse, you know, the incarcerations, all of this stuff.
Depression.
And to me, we'll always be saving the whale and the rainforest until we take care of human beings. Because when you have somebody healthy, they're not going to do that. I mean, when I get out, I would kill a whale just to do it. I'd chop down a great redwood tree just to hear it fall. Because I didn't care about me. Why should I care about anything else?
Of course.
That's part of the reason. The other reason, while I was in the Marines, you know, I had orders to go to Vietnam because of my great attitude. And I was supposed to go over with five other men. My orders got changed when I got there. They all went. A month before I got out, I met one of them limp, and I said, "What happened?" He said, "We all got shot and two were dead." And I was angry and arrogant. And I decided, you know what? I'm not going to wear shoes. You know, that's my memorial to them. They fought for my freedom. I can do what I want. But if anybody asked me how come I didn't wear shoes for the next 33 years, I'd say, "I don't feel like it. You got a problem with that?"
Mm-hmm.
Until a child asked me. When that child asked me, "How come you don't wear shoes?" It was like God said to me, "What are you doing?" And when I told that child, that's the first person in 33 years, nobody knew why, I realized that I had a hollow memorial. I hadn't helped a soul, because I would always say, "So what? Who cares? It doesn't matter." Well, I learned that day it matters to me and I care. And if I don't do anything, I allow this to happen. Because I've had my high school friends get killed over there. I've had them commit suicide. I've had them change. I see the homeless. I walking across this country, you know, I thought I'm just getting signatures. And I didn't really realize how important that signature was. I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get some signatures. When a person signs that petition, he has changed the world. Because you know what? He has said, "This is what I believe in. This is what I stand for. I draw my line in the sand here. I put my money where my mouth is when I put a stamp on that envelope and then send it to Congress." And you know what? He has made a difference, because I used to think that I'm not even part of this world, so whatever I did, it didn't matter. Everything I do matters. It matters.
Can I tell you
a
thing? I don't know if you know about this, Ron, but the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh has a retreat for Vietnam vets in Plum Village in France, mm-hmm. And it's because the level of depression and suicide and self-contempt, because, you know, you were forced to kill and
right.
kill children. And the soldiers go over there, and what he does is he has them going out to the village and helping poor people, sort of like helping children and
right.
sponsoring children and mentoring children and all of this giving back protocol. I know, well, here's the question I'm getting to. I know that you are talking about a 12-step program that you think might be healing. And I find that really important and really fascinating. Could you tell us how that looks?
Okay. Now, the third step we have is, you know, like it's similar to a 12-step program, and it would be a PTSD support group. So it would be veterans, you know, guys that have been out a while, that have been through the ringer, leading a support group for young men and women coming out. Because when, you know, soldiers are asked to do the unspeakable, and then they're not allowed to speak about it. So it eats them from the inside out. I mean, I met one woman, she begged her husband for a year to tell her, tell me what happened. It's okay, you can tell me. He told her, and she says, "Oh my God, how could you do that?" Then he commits suicide, and she has carried the guilt for 40 years. So if we have, you know, their peers leading the support group, they're not going to judge them, because they know they've been there. They've done it. They understand. So they're going to be safe there. They can say whatever they want. And, I mean, on this walk across the country, I have heard stories that are worse than you see in horror movies. And they live with that. And you know, one of the greatest services I did for them was just being able to listen and just be there so they could get it off their chest. And I was there, and one of the hardest things I had to do is every day I would meet a family member of somebody that committed suicide. And I thought they would be the ones stepping up to the plate to sign this petition. And they are destroyed. They blame themselves. Their mantra is, every single one of them, they don't even have never met one another. I heard this almost every day. It's my fault. He told me. I didn't believe him. I should have known. It's my fault. And I've asked people to start support groups for them because they carry a burden of guilt. Their families just fall apart, and their children have an 85% chance of committing suicide because the children blame themselves. If I was better, my mother wouldn't have done this. My father wouldn't have killed himself. If I was better, I could have done something. That's a child. This child's life is destroyed. And if they do live, they carry a burden that is unbelievable. So that is one of the hardest things I had done on this trip. People say, oh, you know, how are your feet? My feet are nothing compared.
Well, Ron, I want to ask you, do you think there's a different set of answers for Vietnam vets as opposed to the Iraqi, Afghanistan, Kuwait war vets? Do you think there's a different answer for them?
Well, no, it's the same answer. I mean, we definitely weren't treated well when we got out. So we had any guilt, it was magnified when we got out. These guys still have guilt. You know, one of the disservices people do to these young men and women, they come home, they'd say, oh, you know, thank you for your service, but, oh, you know, it's about oil. No soldier wants to believe that his friend died for oil or that he killed another human being for oil. He wants to believe that he fought for the freedom of his country and to protect his family.
Right.
So, you know, people say those things, and they don't mean anything bad by it, but they don't want to hear it. So you just say thank you, and you let it go because you have no idea because you weren't there, and they were there. So, you know, if people just say thank you and let it go at that, because that's all you can really do, because who really knows, you know, who has that intel? I don't have that intel to even make a statement like that. I made it once, and I would never make it again.
Well, how do you think it's going, your mission? How is it? How do you think it?
Well, you know what? I am encouraged greatly because I meet so many people that are doing so many things, and I see it starting to change. I mean, I just spoke with a woman today that's starting a group, and it's called Traumatic First Aid. And what they do, because she explained it to me that, you know, when they get in that fight or flight mode, what happens, they get stuck up there at that high level of fight or flight mode, and they just stay there. So what they do is they bring them down. And this is a technique that takes minutes. And they get them to say, okay, folks, do you feel your foot? Okay, feel your foot. And then start to feel the other parts of your body so you get back into your body and in the present moment. Because these guys, and she teaches people to teach this, and it's one of the things, I mean, we have our petition is 3 points, but we want to add more points when we go speak to the Committee for Veterans Affairs. Because she's been doing this with them, and now they have her there every month at Fort Hood working with the soldiers, getting them to calm down, getting them to lower their stress level, and getting them back down. And she explained it well. I mean, I'm not the brightest bulb on this tree. I mean,
it's a little bit like rapid eye movement therapy.
Yes, that's exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of techniques that we want to do in this seminar, so they have a lot of tools, because some things will work better for others. Where, you know, if you believe in a technique, it's going to work better for you than if you don't believe it. If you don't believe
it, you're not
going to do it.
Can I ask you, I've read studies. Sometimes this is what I do at 3 o'clock in the morning. They did, because I study positive psychology. They took some Vietnam vets. Half of them, they told them that if you have post-traumatic stress syndrome, you can come out with post-traumatic upgraded brain. And I'm not remembering what the term of it was, but it's on the internet, this study, and it's on YouTube. And the half of the group that they said, if you go through this trauma, you can come up with better mental capabilities if you think so. the group that they told they could do better after they got through it did remarkably better. Their anxiety down, you know, went down. Their need for medication went down. The group that were never told that they could get better didn't get better. They continued to disintegrate. So
right.
You talk about the major impact of just a little help telling soldiers, anybody in the military, I don't mean soldiers, this can help you, this works. Just that alone will have an impact.
Well, it also do us so much more because people dedicate a road to the veterans. You know what? The honor of the dead, you take care of the living. And you know what? And if we just did these few things that we want, which would be cheaper than what they're trying to do now, having counselors, the American people are saying, you know what? You're a human being. You know, we understand. We accept you. And that's going to do a whole lot more for anything else because these people, you know, we were in a store and we told the woman what we were doing. And she was a civilian, and she started crying. She said, my son's in the military, and my cousin had committed suicide. And people understand, and they sympathize with her, and, you know, they'd make sure she gets help, and they watch her. If that was a veteran, and he started crying, he would lose his job because, oh, he's got PTSD. You know, we don't want to deal with this. It's going to be an issue. He's a human being. We treat them just like they're machines. If we did these things in boot camp, we're laying the groundwork, and then we're letting them know, you know what, you're a human being. This we made such a stigma with this PTSD that they're different. No, he's a human being, and it's a human condition. And let's
well, Ron,
deal
we've
with
got about way. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I want you to give your information on your website again, and how people can sign your petition, and how they can get a hold of you if they need to reach you.
Sure. The website is thelongwalkhome.org, and the petition is on there for them to sign. We're going to give a copy to everybody on the Armed Service Committee and hopefully hand deliver it to the president in November when we go speak at the Committee for Veterans Affairs. And if everybody does this, then the Armed Service Committee can't say they don't know what the American people want. You know, we're not going to do anything because nobody cares. People sign this petition. They see it. Somebody's going to get enough guts to get up and do something about it because the laws are only what the people do. If we're doing it already, they'll pass the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And people can get a hold of me. My contact information is on our website, but my phone number is 305-608-5778. We'll go anywhere and talk to anybody so that, you know, they would be as passionate as we are to sign this petition and tell their friends so that we make this happen. Because that number, to me, is not a number. That is a human being. 18 a day commit suicide. And that's not a number. I had some kids say, well, it's only 18. I said, if it was one in my lifetime and it was my child, it would be one
too many. Thank you, Ron, for your passion, and thanks for coming on to be with us tonight. Stephen, you and I have been kind of quiet while Michelle and Ron talked, so I want to thank you so much for bringing this subject to light on our show, Family Matters. It's something we've never discussed, and I just am finding some thoughts that I need to work through to try to make a difference in this arena, because I think this is so incredibly important, and I'm praying that our new generation of combat veterans can avoid such horrendous statistics.
Part of what Ron addressed, and just in one quick sentence here, the cost to America right now is not reflected in 18 veterans taking their lives a day. It's a staggering cost that relates to dysfunctionalism. It's the alcoholism, the drug abuse, the guys that drive and women that drive themselves off a bridge. It's a staggering cost in productivity, and unfortunately, it's only going to get worse unless it's proactively addressed. I'd also add that as the universe is ironic, Ron's birthday happens to be November 11th, which is Veterans Day. So I'm thinking Ron was born to do what he's doing.
That's terrific. Well, thank you both so much for being here. Michelle, as always, we've had
thank
an
you, everybody.
Show. I learned a lot tonight. Thanks, you guys. And
thank you for
don't forget our Great. I'm so glad you were here, Ron. Don't forget our conference in Chicago is May 21st, a Visitation Interference Parental Alienation Conference. You can still sign up. Find us on Facebook. We're right there. Look me up and send your money in and get there. It's not too late to register. Thank you all for being here. If you have questions, the contact information, everything, the show is downloadable on the website. It's all there for you. So have a great, great Wednesday night. Thank you all again, and tune in 2 Wednesdays from now for another exciting show.
Thanks, Jill.
Semper
Thanks,
Fi, everybody.
Everybody. Take care.
Semper Fi.
Thank you.
Be well and be safe.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye.